Hi, welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired, break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We have a special guest who's here for a second mentoring conversation, Debbie Unterman. She's a clinical hypnotherapist, author, mediator, speaker, and game inventor. She likes to help people see things clearly in some non-traditional ways. In her book, Talking to Myself, Learning to Love the Voices in Your Head, Debbie describes an array of characters she says we all have rattling around in our brains, such as the judge, the rebel, the victim, and maybe even a Ms. or Mr. Perfect. As a master alchemist and trainer, she's been delving inside people's heads for the last 34 years. Debbie achieved proven results with clients suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, sexual abuse, depression, codependency, phobias, anxiety, lack of direction, sex and relationship issues, and much, much more. But even though she can help you work through your issues, she's very interested in creating a new paradigm of playing through your issues, in quotations, which is what she is doing with hundreds of people who are playing her transformational board games. One of them is Clarity and the other Satori, the game of radical forgiveness. Welcome to the program, Debbie.
Thank you, Nancy.
Oh, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. There is so much to talk about. In our first conversation, we were learning a little bit about you, and we learned a little bit about what a master alchemist does, or a clinical hypnotherapist, kind of the deep recesses of the brain, and you look at the root cause of something and try to unhinge it in a way through hypnosis that help, which a person is in control of themselves and during these hypnotherapy sessions, right?
Yes, and another difference between how I work and how most people who go to any kind of therapy work is I like to really go deep, so I work with people in a 2 to 3 hour format at one time. So we're really going deep.
Oh, that's so great, because then you're not so worried about the clock. I mean, that's what I hated about talk therapy. You know, it's like, okay, 50 minutes, you know, time's up. And I'm like, hey, I'm just getting started.
Exactly. You just about said hello.
Yeah. And then I'm like, how am I supposed to resurrect that in another week or two? You know, it was very unsatisfying. But at the same time, it also was helpful. But I can see where the work that you're doing dislodges the pain that, you know, is buried somewhere in our subconscious and also in our bodies. And I love that about what you're talking about with your work. I was wondering, in achieving the status of a master alchemist, where did you go to school and how do you become a master at what you're doing?
Well, there are a few schools in the country that teach it. There may be one in Colorado, definitely in California, and I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. There's really not too many places. So it's a matter of the thing about hypnosis is it's not regulated. And even alchemical hypnotherapy right now is kind of splitting into different boards, certifying boards that have different requirements. So the one that I'm affiliated with has the requirement of 200 hours for the first level of certification. and 300 hours to become a clinical hypnotherapist. And that's a lot of hours. I actually think that it takes even more than that, because we have a lot of very specific protocols and we work differently than a lot of hypnosis schools because we are under really tight supervision where we have one assistant per three students actually watching you do these two-hour sessions on people right there over your shoulder. So you're not just practicing at home or, you know, some kind of fly-by-night organization that comes in, gives you an experience of hypnosis and says, and, you know, slaps you a certificate and says, you're now a certified hypnotherapist, which can happen in America. You can see people who have had 30 hours of training and they can call themselves a hypnotherapist. So it's a good question. You know, look at who you want to be trained with. And if you do want to, if you're the type of person, I say, you know, I'm the one that's like inquiring minds like to know, you know. And so instead of just telling people, now you're going to, you know, be able to face the world with fresh eyes and, you know, you have confidence and, you know, I want to really know. Let's go back to that time that some bully on the playground, you know, pushed you down and you were made fun of by everybody. You know, I go into the story deeply, into the actual incidents that happened to them. And we change those incidents. And we find sometimes when there wasn't a parent that was capable of taking care of you, we sometimes have to go into what we could call the angelic realm, yeah. You know, the spiritual realm, and find some kind of like guardian angel or, you know, archangel or maybe it's like Jiminy Cricket. It could, you know, it could be anybody.
Yeah.
That can do the work for you because, you know, you need a resource to help you to heal.
So and that aligns too with like there's more and more people who are being trained as spiritual directors.
Yes, I love that.
So that's kind of one element of your work that you were just
talking about. I think Caroline Mace uses that term, spiritual director. I love that term. Yes, but we, you know, we also
who's Caroline
are not,
Mace?
She has written. She has a lot of books. I can't think of the Sacred Contracts, I think, is one of her books. And her name looks like it's Carolyn, but it looks like M-Y-S-S, but she pronounces it Mace. I think it's Caroline. Anyway, she's wonderful, and she uses that spiritual director. But the thing that I want to make sure is I might be directing them, but I am not their spiritual director. I want them to find their spirit guide within.
Yes. There's some other questions that are around that. And we also want to focus time on understanding to your upbringing. And why don't we move into that? And maybe at the end, you can offer some tips for people to help them with their inner child if they aren't seeing someone or aren't don't have access right now to some tools to help them to nurture their inner child and heal their wounds. And so we can talk about resources at the end.
Okay, just remind me.
Yeah, no problem.
Because I could talk about that right now if you want.
do you want to take care of that right now and then we'll move on?
I will tell you that the number one thing that I want my clients to do once I see them, if they knew I was going to tell them this, they might not ever want to come to see me. But I'll tell it as a blanket statement because I think if the whole world would sleep with a stuffed animal,
oh, really?
I think that would change the world.
Oh, my God. I've never heard anyone say that. Okay.
I know. That's what I want to do to change the world. I want everybody to have their own teddy bear that is their inner child that they can look at and talk to and hug and hold and keep safe. And see, so it serves two purposes. For one thing, we're programmed. Okay, I want to teach this because there is no instinct for self-love. Do you know that? We don't have, as human beings, there's nothing in our makeup that tells us we have to love ourselves. Nothing. There's no instinct. It doesn't matter if we love ourselves. But what we are wired for is to love babies.
Right. That's
right?
Where you learn empathy.
Right.
Yeah.
So something with two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, right? Stuffed animals have two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, right? They're cute like puppies.
And you don't have to take them out to clean their poop up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Low maintenance.
And look at children themselves. You don't have to teach a child to hug a teddy bear.
Oh, right.
Right?
Yeah.
They know it instinctually because they're wired to love it. You know, I didn't like dolls growing up as a kid, but I still had a stuffed animal. I think it was a dog, but you know, it has two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, you know? And so it's cute. We're wired to love that, to think it's cute, to want to cuddle with something like that. So people sometimes say, well, I sleep with a pillow, or I already do sleep, you know, pillows don't have two eyes and a mouth. Unless they've got faces on them. So draw a face on your pillow if you want to, and then sleep with it. But it has to be cute. And then, so it's serving two purposes. It's letting us have something cute, and then we have to call it our name. So for me, it's my little Debbie. For you, it would be your little Nancy. We have to know that this is our representative of our inner child that's
on us
every night. And then when we go to bed and we hug it, guess what? Our eyes are now closed. So what have we become? We've become that little girl or boy who slept with a stuffed animal when we were little. And our nervous system feels better, just like little kids feel better when they have their teddy bear in their crib or in their in the car seat or, you know, in the bed with them. So as our eyes are closed and we're curling up with it, it's putting our nervous system into that place of peace and safety. And so we're loving and we're being loved at the same time.
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. So the next time you're tempted to sleep with the wrong person, grab a teddy bear instead.
And don't let your husband or wife get jealous of your teddy bear. They should have their own too.
Yes, that's right. Oh, that's wonderful advice. That's the best advice I've ever heard. Okay,
good.
Wonderful. Okay. Anything else you want to comment there with advice?
That's it. If I could just spread that one thing, my work is done.
All right. Well, I'll help you spread it.
Okay. And I'll give you the statistic. Did you know that 10% of English businessmen have a teddy bear?
No, I didn't know that. Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we'll make this, a popular trend in the United States here. All right. Wonderful. So let's turn into, two stuffed animals talking. just using our imagination here. No, let's talk a little bit more about your upbringing.
Okay. Well, I am 64 years old now, so I was born in 1953. So I'm a product of, Leave It to Beaver, Donna Reed, My Little Margie, My Three Sons. You know, I don't know, maybe some of these shows are sounding familiar to some of you. The Three Stooges, Little Rascals, you know.
Yeah.
That was my era. And even when someone like Mary Tyler Moore, got on the air from Minneapolis and became, a liberated woman, she still... if we look at her today, she's not that liberated. But what did she have to do? She had to have that hairdo, right, with that flip.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I didn't like to do it. Like I already said, I didn't like to play with dolls. I didn't want to curl my hair. I didn't want to put it in rollers and have a hairstyle like that. I just didn't really fit in. To those, little girly times. I didn't even like wearing dresses. Never mind those Mary Jane shoes with the little socks that you had to wear.
Yeah,
oh, my
right.
God. I was a tomboy. I hated all that stuff. So, trying to fit in to that was round peg, square hole for me. It was really hard. So you know, my parents didn't do anything wrong. They just expected me to be what, you know, everybody expected a little girl to be at that time. And as I tried my best, and one of my traumas was even, you know, at 5 years old when I was going to be going to first grade the next year, my next door neighbor started teasing me. Debbie, what are you going to do? You're going to have to wear a dress when you go to school, you know, all that stuff. I mean, people knew I was a tomboy. And so, you know, I would just take all that pain of trying to fit in and be what I was expected to be, a good little girl. You know, I didn't have a bad life, but I just didn't really fit in. And I put it into my stomach. I just got stomach aches all the time trying to be a good little girl. It wasn't like anyone was really doing anything terrible. I mean, you know, I told the story last time of my father spanking me for using the word damn because my grandmother used it. And, you know, I was spanked. And there was some yelling in the house. And, you know, it wasn't a perfect household, but it was basically pretty good. And yet I was in pain. I was in really, really bad pain almost, you know, half my life. During school, I would have to go to the nurse's office and lay down. And I started going to hospital, you know, doctors for GI series of tests, which is drinking barium.
Oh, if you remember yuck, that. Yes. You know,
or having it put up the other end.
Oh, you know, God.
Upper and lower GI series. I went through that many times. They even had me, because I grew up in Massachusetts, I was in Massachusetts General Hospital for 3 days of testing in sixth grade, and they found nothing. What they would diagnose it with these days would be IBS. It would be called irritable bowel syndrome. They called it spasmodic colon syndrome, finally.
Okay.
You know, for hardly any reason, but they, you know, and they said maybe like a little excess acid, kind of pre-ulcer, stop eating pizzas and drinking Cokes and, you know, the things that kids want to do. So it made life worse.
Yeah.
But I was on strong medicine. It was something called belladonna, which is like a poisonous plant that they had to give me to stop the spasms in my colon and in my stomach. And I had to have a little white pill with me all the time in case my stomach would start hurting.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it got worse in junior high. I moved from Massachusetts, which was a pretty safe place for me, to Long Island, New York.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard. I did not fit into Long Island. I didn't know what Long Island was. I know now it's a keep up with the Joneses kind of place, and I didn't want to keep up with the Joneses. I didn't want to curl my hair, and I didn't want to, you know, do the things that girls were supposed to do.
Yeah.
So it became worse. I couldn't keep up with all the cheerleader types, and I didn't have any friends, whereas I did in Massachusetts. And I was really in the nurse's office all the time during school. I'd come home from school, and I would just go to sleep. And my mother would say, if you don't stop, you know, sleeping so much, I'm going to send you to the doctor. Or, you know, that's what I did anyway. And then when I'd go to the doctor and they would ask me, you know, well, they would be asking my mother and I, you know, so do you have any trouble emotionally fitting in or anything? And my mother would answer. She'd say, no, she's very well adjusted.
Oh.
So they weren't listening to me. Nobody was hearing me. I wasn't, you know, and I don't even know if I would have been able to say anything. I don't know if I would have known what it was.
Sure.
But, you know, you talked in the last show about meditating. What happened when I went to college was I started going, well, it was two things that happened. I started meditating and I started the feminist movement was just start. It was 1971 when I went to school. And by 72, I joined my first consciousness raising group and I started finding my place. Started realizing that, oh, feminism exists. And then, you know, I meditated. I went into Students for International Meditation and started meditating. And
transcendental meditation?
Yes.
Yeah.
TM,
yes.
Which you sort of do twice a day for 20 minutes a day. And within 3 months of meditating twice a day, my lifelong problem with my stomach aches was almost gone, where I could let go of those pills and live, you know, pretty pain-free instead of having, you know, an episode every day or, you know, a few times a week. Then I was having them maybe only every few months. So it started calming down. And also around that same time, I also came out with the gay movement. The feminist movement allowed me to find myself also as knowing why I didn't fit in, because I didn't even fit into heterosexuality. And that was huge. I mean, if anyone has ever talked about the coming out process, it is letting, lifting just a weight off of your shoulders and your stomach and anywhere else. You can finally breathe. You can be yourself. And so all the stuff I was repressing was finally something I could commit to. I could express.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, I could, I say in the book, I finally realized I could breathe my Debbie-ness into myself. One of the very first things I do with my clients is I teach them how to breathe, because a lot of people are not taking full breaths.
Yeah, right. Especially if you're feeling stress and anxiety. You know, you tend to do a lot of shallow breathing.
Yes, and it isn't good for you. And so some people, you know, might get stomach aches, some might get back aches, some might get headaches, some might get knee aches. You know, it expresses differently in everybody. But
it shows up physically, is your point.
Yes, and there is a reason. The body is talking to you. And if you can learn what the body is saying, the pain can go away. Here we are with the opioid crisis right now.
Right.
With people just wanting to take a pill. Well, sometimes we need to listen and allow that pain to speak, to tell us what it's trying to say.
Exactly.
And it makes us feel better when we listen to it, when we can finally figure out what it's been saying. And it's often an exact duplicate of what it's said to you. Like, you know, maybe, you know, someone with ankles, maybe it's that they're not moving forward, or they're not standing on their own 2 feet, or something like that.
Or with my hips, I attribute it to the difficulty I've had in just moving forward.
Okay, I was wondering if you found a relationship between your hips. Good.
Yeah, Louise Hayes.
Yes.
Are you familiar with her work, Heal Your Body?
Definitely. I have it right by my in my session room. I look it up sometimes for clients.
Yeah, that Louise Hayes has been like a real eye-opener for me, connecting what's happening with my body to connecting to, you know, what's happening in my mind and... and that my body, you know, helping me interpret my body a little better.
For sure. It's so important for us to know that we are a system. And if there's something wrong with the system, we have to look for it, troubleshoot. What is it? What's going wrong? What is it telling us?
Well, and you grew up at a time, too, where, you know, I mean, that's when the pills, I mean, you were in doused with these harsh ways of treatment. You know, there was no alternative methods to help you understand a little bit more about yourself, or no one saying, hey, we've got some other ways, you know, to take a look at what's going on in your life.
Well, okay, I don't think things have changed that much. You know, we're talking the opioid crisis, and let's talk about the, you know, the abuse crisis, if you want to call it a crisis. I mean, when you look at how many women are in therapy, probably 50% of them have been sexually abused.
Well, I'm in the Me Too category.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what happens is it becomes a secret. It is stuffed down, you know, sometimes literally down your throat, sometimes literally.
Yeah.
people have to keep quiet because they're told if you tell, you know, something bad will happen. I'll kill your dog. I'll give your dog away. I'll hurt your sister. They'll never believe you. Why would anyone believe you instead of me? So, you know, the secrecy of it. And so what's happening now, you know, how many people have bodies that are holding secrets? And doctors today, just like then, they're not listening to the bodies. They're looking for a solution to make the pain go away. They're not asking, why might you have this pain?
Yeah.
But how many people, and doctors don't ask a question, and people don't just offer it.
Well, do you think that we're having like this awakening about sexual abuse in a way? It's like all forces coming together. There's just like so many different cases are coming into light, and there's documentaries that are out. I don't know that I want to go into like all, you know, people know what's going on looking at have you seen the documentary Keepers?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, that's about this nun in Boston, one of the first Catholic communities that was here. It was just a shining, wonderful school. And this priest ended up like, they believe that he murdered or had someone murder this sister Catherine, and there's a petition that was signed just recently by Pope Francis to open up the records because the students of Sister Catherine, I'm drawing a blank with their last name right now, but it's easy to find. Anyways, in the documentary, there's a group of students that she taught at this girls' school that were sexually abused by this priest, and they had confided in Sister Catherine about this abuse. And what happened as a result of that is that Sister Catherine was going to do something about that.
Right. So they silenced her.
Yes. But if that crime wasn't enough, there has been like the silencing of all the files, and it's like the whole community kind of conspired to keep this information from coming out because it was a huge Catholic community, so the
right.
police officers and the judges and you know, it was a whole system of people who didn't want to talk about this, and
of course,
and so anyways, now these students of Sister Catherine's have grown up and they're saying unlock the documents.
Yeah, because they're saying me too, right? They're saying it happened.
And
to me.
One thing they've learned, like about what's interesting about the documentary too, is that pedophiles do not want to let go of their paraphernalia. And so this priest had this cemetery guy in the way back part of the cemetery dig this huge hole where he had all, because they, you know, there was this investigation going on. They were moving him around to different communities. So our whole faith community in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, was built on this kind of moving priests around instead of really confronting them for, you know, the horrific crimes that they were doing and producing. And so this priest had all this paraphernalia, you know, of girls and pictures and in compromised positions. And anyways, he had this cemetery guy bury the stuff. And then when the police found out about it, then somehow there was a tip that was left out for the priest. So he somehow confiscated all the materials. No, I don't think it was that. I think that the police you know, hid all the information and said they didn't find anything. But so there's all these different pieces. So this documentary is on the search to find out who killed Sister Catherine, because they want to remember her and respect her, the legacy that she's built. And it shows also all these different victims, these girls coming forward expressing what happened to them. And so it's still going on today. But I just think that that's out there, that we've got these other sexual predators that are, there's a collective group of people that are just coming forward. And you can't ignore the victims anymore.
Exactly. This is what I just came to today in my mind. I started thinking, I don't know how old you are, how into all this stuff you've been, but in 1987, we had something called 56?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you remember the harmonic convergence on August 17th, 1987? The harmonic convergence.
No.
That was one of the first openings of the world, of the secrets of the world. And they started coming out. It was kind of like something that was portended, almost like the Mayan calendar, like 2012. You know, 1987 to 2012, I think, was exactly 25 years, and there's a 50-year period. But anyway, what's happening right now is secrets are coming out. Now, they started coming out after 87, and really, things were becoming unearthed. It was hard for anybody to hold secrets for very long. But what happened in the 90s, just when I thought, yay, because remember, I started doing this work in 83, so I already knew a lot about sexual abuse by 87. So by the 90s, we were really swinging with the movement. We were, you know, people were starting to get healed. And what crops up? Something called the Memory Syndrome Society. Now, who makes up this society? The men, the rich men, lawyers, doctors, judges, the rich men who have been who have been accused by their daughters of sexually abusing them and who lawyer up. And so the False Memory Syndrome Society started closing down all the court cases that the courts were filling with. The society came in and they had lawyers to take care of all of these. And there's all these statutes of limitations.
Yeah, right.
Now, the way the brain works, these memories don't come up like the memory of my father spanking me for saying the damn milkman. That was not that traumatic. I can maintain that memory and retain it in my mind, and I can remember it like it happened yesterday. But when someone is abused to their core, those memories don't just go into nice little pockets. They get stored all over the brain like someone took a big jigsaw puzzle of, you know, 2,000 pieces, threw it up in the air, and it all landed in your brain in different places. And that's how it comes together, like puzzle pieces. So the idea that there's a statute, a limitation for these memories to come up is insane.
It is insane.
So now we are at another octave. That's what I'm feeling. Like now, since the 2012, we're at another octave of secrets coming up. And I don't think they're going to be able to go back into the box again.
Because women are raising into, they're becoming more powerful. They're moving into powerful positions. And so you can't stop equality, and you can only silence women you can only silence women when they don't have power or position or money.
But and, you know what? There's safety in numbers too. And it's when one person accuses Bill Cosby, when one person accuses Clarence Thomas, it's not enough. Anita Hill lost. Clarence Thomas is now a Supreme Court judge for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
You know, that did not work. One woman, and that was a powerful woman's voice. And those were powerful testimonies if you watched the court case.
Yeah, I saw everything. Yeah. I felt like a woman coming forward with any sexual allegations is a problem, and it's her problem. It's not the men's problem. It's it's the women's problem. And women are not safe anywhere. That's what I learned from that experience.
In numbers, we will be safe in numbers. But you know what else? We have to also make sexuality sacred and take it out of the, you know, this place where we make it this dirty little secret. Like, did you hear what happened with Kevin Spacey? He just got outed by a 14-year-old boy who he harassed. So finally sexual harassment of a man with a boy came out. And what happened? Kevin Spacey decided to come out. Well, was it safe for gay men to come out in Hollywood or anywhere else? Would they lose their jobs? Was it safe for women to come out if they were harassed? No, they lost their jobs. You know, there's still a good old boys network of protecting and of playing as if, you know, you fit in and you put up with whatever you have to put up with. And whenever something like that happens, it goes into the shadow. So what happens with priests? They could have been possibly happy homosexuals and instead, or happy heterosexuals, but instead something in them repressed their sexuality.
Well, not something in them. It's their, well, yeah, I guess you're saying that. It's the vow of chastity. And that is also becoming more focused on as, you know, isn't that an abnormal vow to take?
It might be because it seems that guys can't live with it.
We were made as sensual and sexual beings. I mean, why is that such a bad thing?
Exactly. And so there has to be movement in this world that, you know, men are not allowed to hit a woman in the ass and, you know, make comments about her. And, you know, that people just chuckle. They think it's cute. The whole, you know, bunny culture, Hugh Hefner and, you know, our president and other people that think it's okay. It's just locker room talk.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be an end to accepting locker room talk. Men have to get on this movement too and stop laughing at the jokes and start saying something.
And there are many men that are joining the movement.
They have to. It won't work. It won't work without men refusing to participate any longer in that good old boy network.
Yes.
And so something is moving now. But also homosexuality is way more accepted. I mean, the new generation, the next, you know, the kids, they don't care. They don't care. It's just, are you or aren't you, you know? It's not like it's going to be a thing anymore.
Right. Well, because they've grown up, like my daughter's grown up, our daughter has grown up too with, you know, parents who are lesbians, you know, and gay men who are parents who have children in the school system. And seeing that and experiencing that with these kids has opened up their eyes to see that there are many ways in which people are living their lives.
Exactly.
And
normalized. It's become something that has been taken out of, oh no. I mean, do you remember what it was like back then? Like the Children's Hour, Lillian Hellman, you know, who ends up killing herself because she's a teacher in love with another teacher, and the play ends with a gunshot. She kills herself over being gay. I mean, this was just, well, I don't know if it was the 40s or 50s, but I mean, times are really, really, really changing.
Yeah. And people need to not be scared of these changes, but find ways to, you know, get to know people and understand their lives and offer a lot more empathy by trying on the shoes of somebody else and walking in their shoes for a while.
I, And I think it's come to kind of the 100th monkey effect, where everyone has, you remember the term funny uncle, you know,
right.
A spitster aunt, you know, it used to be that we just made stories up about them, you know, but now almost everyone has someone in their family or a neighbor who is gay. And so, you know, now it's been personalized.
Yeah.
Like, so when I was 22, I guess, and I took over my Gay Freedom League at college, I started going to English composition classes and speaking, bringing a panel of people. And we were the first gay people they ever met or knew in their lives. You have to put a face to the scariness, and then you take the fear away.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what I think the theme of today is, to let things out.
Yeah.
Talk about them. Make them okay. Normalize things. And then, you know, you've taken the charge, and it doesn't have to go into that deep, dark shadow and come out as something revolting and criminal.
Well, that's the only way that you can really heal, is by shedding mm-hmm. light on,
exactly.
on the secrets, right? The
exactly.
secrets die, you know.
When you turn the light on. Yeah.
Right.
Let
right.
them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like you've been really a courageous person, kind of setting, pioneering your own path throughout your life.
I do feel like a pioneer in the movement. I watched the movie, what's the one about the tennis match that just came out?
Dual, yeah.
What's it called? You know, dual
center. Yeah. It's right on the tip of my tongue. Martina Navratilova.
Yeah.
Navratilova and.
Well, Steve Carell plays him.
Yeah, I'll put that in the notes so that.
And it was.
What we can't think of, it'll be in the notes.
It duplicated my process exactly. It was 1972, 1973 when I entered the feminist movement and the gay. Liberation Front. It was so much fun to watch that. Battle of the Sexes.
Battle of the Sexes, yes.
Yes. It was perfect. And I really hope a lot of people watch, because they may not know that history. It is 100% true. And so what happens? Not Maria Navratilova, it was...
Martina.
No, it wasn't Martina.
No.
No, it was an American. This is terrible. Where are our memories?
Yes.
Where have they gone? I know who it is. I can picture her with
all
glasses.
Right.
But she, one of the main points, the plot points, is that there was a time in her life where she was married. Her husband
was Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs.
Yes, and Bobby Riggs.
Yes.
And Billie Jean King goes through a whole secret lesbian love affair during that movie. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, who would know that there would be so much trauma involved with that?
Yeah.
You know, it's so sad when you think about all the people who have had to have terrible ends to their careers. I mean, look at Ellen. Look what she went through.
Ellen DeGeneres.
She had to go, yes, just to come out. She almost lost her career.
Right.
But she was brave. And then it turns out that Whitney Houston... I watched her biopic. It was a real movie. I mean, it was real, you know, documentary about her life. And she had a woman that was with Bobby Brown and her. She could have been very happy as a lesbian before she met Bobby Brown. And her mother could not accept it. This was it's a documentary. It was HBO. It's probably on right now. And unbelievable. Who would know that even when Oprah interviews her mother and says, so now that you know about Whitney, would it have been okay for her to have been with a woman? Her mother still says no.
Wow.
You know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just judgment. We just have to let people be who they really are.
Yeah.
You know, my stomach aches. I couldn't be who I really was. I wanted to go to school in pants.
And,
I didn't want to wear dresses. You know?
We know that doesn't work. You know, conforming. It just doesn't work. You know, your true self has to come out. It does come out. But why does it have to be such an ugly, you know, journey and so painful?
And these days the pain is, you know, it's right there in our phones. I mean, suicide has become the number one reason for teenagers dying.
Yeah. So we could talk for hours. There's a lot to say about it.
Obviously.
Everything. Yeah. And I think we only too tapped into your own personal journey too. But I'll have to have you back at another time. And I think that everybody should read your book. It's wonderful the way you really talk about the Carl Jung's archetypal research that he came out with, and talking to ourselves, myself, and learning to love the voices in your head. I mean, this is a really deep perspective, but you lay out kind of the different aspects of those archetypes, like the judge and the skeptic and the preacher and the king and queen and Mr. and Ms. Independent. And, you know, there's all different types of, and I like the exercises that you have at the end of each chapter where you kind of look at, do I fit into this archetype? Like where, if all these archetypes are really part of me, you know, like the teacher part is more elevated in me at different times, and the learner and this. One last thing before we finish out here. The emotional characters, so you have them kind of clumped together, the prince / princess, the rebel, the adventurer, the hero, heroine, the warrior, the sexpot, the artist, and the lover / romantic. I was relating to all those characters, probably stronger than the others.
Ah, then you must live in your body. That's good. I mean, it's kind of where our fear lives, but a lot of people live in their heads and they just suppress all of those parts. There's that sex spot, you know?
Yeah.
That can be suppressed by maybe the, you know, the preacher guru or the judge.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Those other more intellectual parts.
Would you like to talk some more about these different archetypes?
You know, I have this little thing that's on the back of my book. You could almost read along with me that I think will give people an idea, and it will be quick because I know we're probably coming to our end.
Yeah.
So let me just write, because I wrote it so that it's, you know, it's easy to understand. It makes sense. So I say, ever wonder about those voices you hear in your head as if they have a mind of their own? Could that constant chatter really have something to say? Look inside, that means inside the book, to meet the cast of characters that make up the whole of who you are. Make order of the chaotic thoughts that parade through your brain and learn how to hear from your heart. Integrate the voices into a unified inner team that will ignite you toward motivation, commitment, and success. How? First name them, then tame them. Who are they? Well, there's the voice that tells you what you did wrong and how you should be doing everything. That's the judge. Then there's the one that does just the opposite. That's the rebel. There's also the romantic, who has you married off to the cute new guy at the office until the part of you who knows it'll never happen chimes in. That's the skeptic. Or the victim. Let's not forget about the voice you hear nagging you to put on a coat before you catch a cold, just like your mother used to. Wait a minute. That is Mom. What's she doing in my head? She's called an external character, as opposed to the judge and the 20 other internal parts or subpersonalities you'll discover. And there's more. After finding all of yourselves, learn why you sometimes need them to quiet down. Shh. Can you hear the whispers and wisdom of your inner guides? Find out how they can direct you toward joy, creativity, and the fulfillment of your life's purpose. It's all inside.
That's beautiful. Oh, Thank you so much. I just want to clarify one thing. Like I said, I'm part of the Me Too, and I just want to not scare anybody or get a lot of emails about this. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to share my experience on air, but it happened a long time before I got married. And the beauty of my life experiences, I did a lot of work on myself to prepare myself to be married. And that's why I wasn't ready to be married until I met Matthew, and I got married at age 39. And so I did a lot of work, and I just wanted to clarify that for people so that they're not thinking like, you know, it's happening in my marriage. you know, I've got a beautiful, wonderful husband and daughter, and I just never thought I could be loved this much. And I never thought Matthew and I didn't think we would even have children. And so we just really lucked out there because I just feel like I've got the best daughter in the world. I always tell her that. So I just want people to know that I'm really in a solid, fantastic relationship with my husband, and he's helped me heal so much. And I love both of them very much with my whole being. So anyways.
Good disclaimer. And I hope that anybody who says Me Too is not still in the relationship where it happened.
Yeah, that's really another good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for those who are struggling, I think that they should get your book and they can read it while they squeeze their teddy bear. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's really fun, and time flew again.
It has. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, photographer, brother from another mother. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you all next Monday.